Yo, guys, Charlie, what did happen? Welcome to the If More, Let's Divide podcast. For today's episode, I hope this guest won't make me nervous or won't make me frightened or won't make me think a whole lot. I hope so, because one, she's smart, she's pretty, she is adorable, and she's my friend.
Yes.
Fred, what do you know about her?
So my experience with her primarily was off social media.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we're both very limited, you know, participation in social media, especially Twitter.
Yeah.
But I used to read her thought process. She's one of the people that I took mental note of, that if she ever said something, I would go and actually read to process what the information was. Because you know how there are some people on social media who just talk to talk.
Yeah.
But this, I think it was a pattern of, you can follow somebody's identity, at least in their thought process. Yeah. She was one of the people that I identified as such. So yeah, that's the extent of what I know about.
Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, help us welcome Kuku Abamfo! Charlie Kukua, what a guan. What's going on? It's been ages.
I thought more than 5 years, but you said it's not more than 5 years.
Mm. 5 years?
I think, or more.
But it feels like I see you every now and then, maybe because of, you know...
5 years Instagram. Is actually 2019.
Pardon?
5 years is actually 2019. Yeah. That's crazy.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but it feels like I see her...
Since COVID, so...
Mm. Yeah. And then you reached out to me on Instagram. I had no clue that you were in Ghana.
Yeah. I move in silence.
Yeah, you mean. So,
Well, except for now, because now everybody will know.
Yeah. So, what are you in Ghana for?
Good question. For my employers watching, I'm here working on my book and doing field research and also visiting my family.
Mm. Yeah. How long have you been away? Or you sneak in every now and then?
I won't say sneak, but I've come a couple of times, but just for very brief visits. So the last time I came, I was running a workshop, and it was very, it was 10 days, very tight.
Oh, okay.
Came, I did the 10 left. Mm. But this is the first time that I'm here for an extended period, because I'm doing this field research, and I just have some more time. Yeah.
Wow.
And I missed all my friends, so it's like, oh, where are you? Let's hang out.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know where the oldies hang out.
Mm. Like, we are oldies now.
We are oldies.
Yeah, actually, that's true.
They call me mommy now.
Oh, Charlie.
I'm like, wait. The first time it happened, I was like, oh, chill.
Yeah. You know what freaks me out? When I go to Accra every time, it's uncle. I say, hey, relax.
We are there.
Yeah, we are there. Yeah, but there. They give me a certain respect as da. I'm like, relax. So it's too much. But we are there.
We're there.
Wait, does that mean that you look older than your age?
Probably. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. Maybe I get out of the big track. They think I'm some big man, so they want to accord me that respect. So I don't know.
I like it, though. I think for a woman, I do like it. Because they don't immediately treat you like a small girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I like it. The mommy will take a while to get used to, but I prefer to the alternative.
Yeah. So, Fred, you want
to? Oh, well, I thought you were going to get into what she does and what.
So let's do it. So, I mean, you are doing dope stuff, very cool stuff, and if people don't know you so well, they would say, "Oh, with Kukua, you just have to talk about books with her, or you have to talk about a particular thing with her." But for people like me who know you, I know that you are an all-round person. You have something to say about everything, right? What's one thing do you think we should know about you that will blow my mind off, that will blow Fred's mind off?
I don't know what will blow your mind off, but one thing that, like, when I say to people, they're like shocked, is how much I love playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's PlayStation, it shocks them.
Or so Atari Lynx.
So I play a bunch on Steam on my computer. It's like this interface, and like a lot of indie artists like make games and put them on there. Yeah. So like I'm always like trying things there. But then I got gifted a Switch a while ago, and like to play Animal Crossing because my friend told me it was very relaxing.
I have Animal Crossing on Switch, but yeah. I never play my Switch.
Yeah, I'm tired of it. Like, yeah. It was too peaceful.
Is Switch an app or is it?
No, it's a console. The Nintendo Switch. If I'm traveling, I go with it. Yeah. I might play on the plane for like an hour and that's it. Yeah. Like, I never ever play.
Yeah, that's how lost I am in the gaming world. Yeah. I am
not a game guy at all.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a game guy. So you like video games?
I like video games.
Do you play football?
No, FIFA? I don't. So I don't like sports video games. So I like sandbox games. I like open world explorers. So I've recently been playing Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
But I'm pacing myself because
it's
I'm like... And one thing about me, which Mutombo, you know, is like, I tend to be goal-oriented. So sometimes when I'm playing a game, like Zelda, I'm like, okay, here's my targets for the day.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill this number. And I'm like, no, that's not the point of playing a game. So I'm trying to chill and not treat it like work, which sometimes, unfortunately, I do.
Yeah. My last question, or a question before Fred comes in. What one question do you keep on asking yourself?
I don't want to give a depressing answer.
Please feel free.
It's kind of depressing. Recently, with everything happening around the world, it's honestly like, what's this all for?
Yeah.
What's the soul for?
What is all this for? Right.
Mm. Like, I've been asking myself that question a whole lot.
Yeah, especially recently. Like, it's really been hard to like be hopeful as a practice. Because it's like, oh my God, the bad guys are winning.
Yeah. And another thing, right? I don't know. I've been asking myself that same question. So then what? To what end?
Mm.
But another question is, like, I've been thinking, I've been thinking about death so much quite recently.
Mm.
Because, like, in the last month, I've lost about 8 people.
Ah.
Wow. Yes. People I know from a distance, close people, you know, about 8.
Yeah.
Wow.
Most are young people.
Charlie. Yeah, I mean, I don't know her personally, but Pukwa's passing was horrifying, you know, man. Still.
And I know her, but I haven't seen her. Like, we are not friends, but I know her. Yeah. And we are friends on Facebook.
Okay.
Just like 3 days ago, I went on my Facebook. I don't go to Facebook, and I saw her. I think people were commenting, so it popped up on my feed. And I'm like, oh, we're friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's crazy, bro.
Yeah. I might hear people saying that it's because of the jabs that most of us took, the COVID shots.
Mm.
That's what they say because they didn't research it properly.
Since we mentioned condolences to her family, by the way, that was tragic. But I mean, the COVID thing that you're saying, I didn't take a shot, only because I think I've told you, I just didn't. It didn't make sense to me how quickly they came up with the vaccine when I know, standard wise, vaccines have traditionally taken a long time to keep passing. Like FDA requirements or whatever the standards are. So it just felt, personally, I was dealing with some health challenges that I was working through. And just because I wasn't certain whether I was high risk or not and all of that, and I was trying to get my health back in order, I'm like, let me not just introduce something else that I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, I'm dealing with something already. Let me just manage it on my own. And my sister was quite furious about it, but I thought taking a gamble was the decision I wanted to make. But you know what? I think the world was going through a lot. And I don't purposely think people were sitting in some corner plotting to kill people. They were just trying to come up with a solution with the challenge that we're all facing. And they probably have made mistakes through the process. So hopefully they are wise enough to learn from it. And that if the world is ever faced with something like that, have a better approach to it. But that's how I kind of choose to look at it.
For me, around that time when COVID came, like traveling, I was traveling a whole lot. So I had to. So I took one in Ghana, took one in the States, took a booster.
I've also taken everyone that has been offered me. But I will say...
everyone that has been offered me.
Yeah, because you know sometimes you're like, oh, if you're not in a high-risk group or like you're not this age, you can't have it. But any time I qualify, I'm like, give me. Yeah. So when I go back, I'm going to like try and plead to get another one because I'm happy with them. But I will say on the time that it took, because in the previous life, I was working around like scientists, like researchers in that, that a lot of the technology that made the COVID vaccine possible people had been working on it for years, for decades.
Okay.
Right. So the recently, this lady that innovated in this mRNA, which I think that's the Moderna, I'm not sure, correct me if I'm wrong, vaccine, had been working on it like pretty much her whole academic career.
Wow.
And she got a Nobel Prize for it. So like the vehicle that then they attach things on. Yeah, because that's the thing about science, right? Sometimes when you are doing research, you have a question in mind, but sometimes you answer it and then it answers so many other questions and it has solutions for it. So I get where you're coming from. Like, I'm never going to tell someone you can trust your government, you can trust Big Pharma, you can trust like the medical institution, especially if you're black.
We
know we can't. But I will say that like the speed, some of that came from work that had been going on for years. And also when you put money into things, like it's amazing what people do and what they come up with. But yeah, I encourage people to take it because then it helps us make the world safer for people who are immunocompromised and things. Like I encourage people to mask in like crowded spaces with no ventilation. But yeah, I don't force people. Like when people are like, I don't take it, I don't try to force them as well. Because also, I get why, especially black people, right? I get why where they're coming from.
I mean, but I also love that you're throwing light on the, because sometimes we lack information. So I've been working with the idea that vaccines take a long time to engineer.
But now
you're sharing the information that process has been accelerated, not because it happened during COVID, but prior to that, people were already working on things. And I think that's valid information. And that's why I don't have a conspiracy theorist disposition on anything. I think we should all arm ourselves with information and know your personal situation and then take information like that to be able to help you make a good decision, because I don't think the vaccine is inherently bad or evil. So.
We don't know. I also like, I think a mark of being a good academic is like, accept that you might not know and you might be wrong. So I am very open to 20 years from now saying they all gave us 666 with the vaccine and I'm like, okay. I guess you never know. Now. Mutombo and I will be in the same corner of hell.
So one thing that I didn't say in the intro is what you do, what you're known for. I've seen you everywhere, and even though we don't touch base every now and then, anytime I see you, I'm like, yes, I know her. Yes, you know, I am your silent cheerleader, you know, in my own corner. You are an architect.
Train that's right? One, yeah.
You are a big time architect. I mean, there was this day, I think in 2022, I saw you on BBC. And I'm like, yeah, that's her. How did you land yourself here?
Okay, so some small clarifications. The BBC thing was a feature for a research project. It was related to architecture, but architecture, history, and archives. So that was what the project was. How did I land here? This is like such a long story and maybe a bit boring. But to summarize, after secondary school, so I did general science in secondary school, which I've aged myself. Well, I guess I already said I'm mommy, so you can age me. But so after secondary school, like after writing, what did we write? WASI?
Yeah.
No, at that time it was SSSC.
Yeah, you
grew. I grew. so I think like my dad definitely wanted me to do medicine. My mom was also flexible. It's like that time, if you go to school and you're smart, like you're going to be a lawyer or an engineer or a doctor, you pick one. You have a choice, but pick one of these three. But my dad really wanted me to do medicine. And I didn't care either way. I didn't have like a particular passion for anything in terms of like professions. But I always loved to draw. I always loved art. I loved making things like... my mom will tell people how I used to cut up her clothes and make clothes for myself out of it. I destroyed a number of radios and video decks because I had an idea to build something else out of it. So I had that, but I hadn't connected in my head that there was a profession out there that like connected to that. But I accompanied a friend who was going to see a career counselor at Legon about her choices, like what she was going to do after school. So I go with her and I'm sitting, I think, in either in the same room or in the waiting room. And he finishes with her. And he's like, oh, and you, what about you? What are you going to do? I'm like, eh, I don't know. I don't care. And he's like, oh, okay, what do you like? I tell him, he asks me questions. So it comes out that like I like drawing. In school, I liked physics. I like all these subjects. And he's like, oh, do you know about architecture? I'm like, yeah, buildings. But like, do you know what architects do? I'm like, yeah, vaguely. So he tells me to go to Baum Library, because this is a league one we were, to go look up stuff. So I go look up and I'm like, I still can't remember the title of the book that I found. But I look it up and I'm like, they described it as kind of like a melding of all the arts and the sciences as architecture. And I was like, oh my God, this was it. And then they had these examples of Leonardo da Vinci and stuff. And I was like, oh, I kind of like dig this. Like I like to draw. I like to put things together and create things that were in there. So I went home and then I said, okay, I'm going to do architecture. And my dad was not pleased.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. I don't think he ever fully accepted or embraced that I chose it, because he was like, yeah, right up to the end at Tech, he was trying to like, even behind my back, switch to medicine. But by that time, like I was like, oh, now there's something I'm actually interested in. Mm. So I'm going to do architecture.
Wow. So have you gone back to Baum Library to find that book?
No, but I was actually thinking of it, because this is the second time this thing has come up recently.
I think you should find a book and get a copy and put it in your living room or something.
Because it was really random. Yeah.
Oh, so you went to Tech?
Yes, I went to Tech. That was, at the time, that was the only architecture school in Ghana.
No. Mm. Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. Now there's two. There's also Central University College, but for a long time.
But go to Tech.
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, wow.
I mean,
No. I have good friends at Central.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've also seen like work coming out of from people at Central. So both of them.
Yeah. Isn't that where bring your name. Bright. Isn't that where he's doing this program? Or he's in Tech?
Bright Akwe.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tech.
Oh, okay. Because he was talking about the community. Yeah. Anyway, you're living my dream.
Yeah,
I was actually going to say.
Yeah, you're living my dream. Yeah. I wanted to be an architect. I don't think I had the intellectual capacity for it. So here we are.
Really?
Impossible.
Maybe I was too lazy.
Umpe school.
Or maybe I gave myself too many excuses. But I actually wanted to go to either MIT or Parsons.
Yeah.
And you just said something that made sense to me finally. Because I was going to ask you as part of my questions that... How does it seem like architects are a blend of, they are like one step away from becoming either a fashion designer, one step away from becoming like a chef in their architectural like career.
Mm-hmm.
They can pivot quite easily into another creative field. But you saying that and what your process was and then the guy who's the career person leading you to books, it's almost like the definition is like the melting pot of all the creatives and whatnot. Yeah. So I'm not going to ask the question anymore. I'm going to ask about your style.
My style?
Yeah.
Have I got style?
Yes, yes. It's as soon as you walked in, I was like, yes, architect. But not every architect, every single architect I've met has their own look. Mm-hmm. So there's not the architectural look, but the architect themselves seems to have put some thought into how they appear. But it's very simple, usually bordering on monochromatic or simple, like no plenty patterns and stuff. It's very like plain. Am I making sense?
No, you are making sense, and architects definitely do that. I don't always do this.
Okay.
This is like kind of my field, one of my field research uniforms, I guess.
Okay.
I have uniforms. I make uniforms for myself sometimes. Okay. Like my teaching uniform is a white shirt and pants, sometimes colored. Like mostly colored, sometimes like black or gray. That's my teaching uniform my students will hear this now. But like it was my uniform at the beginning where I'm like, okay, I look young. I look like these people's mates, so I need to dress a certain way to kind of like, yeah, so like
create
to
some separation.
To create, yeah, that kind of thing. Because like I want them to relate to me like in a casual way and stuff, but also like, again, the various identities that we have, like people relate to you differently. And also like to just, and I picked this from my mom as well, so like have a kind of like, I don't use the word professional, but like kind of like anything we're doing is we're taking seriously.
Mm.
So it's like even when I was working from home, like I wake up and I dress up and I sit behind my computer. Even though I'm home, I don't wear sweatpants, you know? Mm. So I have different uniforms for things. But I will say that like I wear a lot of bright colors and patterns.
Okay.
As well in different stages as well. Because sometimes like when architects meet, everyone's like wearing black.
So now you teach?
Yes, yes. So my current role, which again my low key life, I'm now from since last August. To August 2023, I'm an assistant professor of architecture at the Tubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan.
Wow. Did you ever see yourself like in this role?
Not from the beginning, but again, so I told you how I entered architecture.
Yeah.
But when I was actually in architecture school, the stuff that I was most interested in was the history stuff and the culture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like so interested in it, and I was interested in like the why things were happening more than like the process, more than the product. Like I was really interested in that. So getting to the end of my six, so architecture is 4 plus 2 years, so 4 years undergrad and then 2 years master's, postgrad now. I think it's all master's now, no one does a postgrad diploma. So my time master's getting to the end, when I was thinking of where to go and work, I'd worked as a TA at first for national service, so very seriously I was like, you know, I want to explore this other side of things. So I didn't do the conventional thing of going to work in an architecture firm. And then I went to work for this organization that was doing programming around architecture, heritage, and culture.
Mm.
So I worked there for a while. And then I also took a job in Cameroon designing for a community around malaria prevention. It was a global fund funded project. So I had to design new houses for this like deprived community.
Wow.
To reduce malaria spread in the community. And so I remember I went and I was like, again, fresh out of like the school system.
Yeah.
I researched local materials and my design proposals were like earth materials, bamboo, like this thing that I was like amazing in my head. And then I one of the things I insisted on doing, because I was reading books about community-led design and things, was to present my ideas to the community for their input. So I go and I show them my thing, and it's like this like earth-formed wall, the bamboo, and they are pissed off. So this Cameroon.
This is the community, right?
There's a community, yeah, this village. And the outskirts of Yaoundé. And you're like, what is this? I'm like, oh, like, this is my design proposal for your new buildings. Do you live in a mud house back in Ghana? Because they know I'm a foreigner. No, that's your father built something like this. Like, honestly, no. And they're like, why should we live in this? And they were like angry with me. They wanted cement blocks. They wanted what they associated with modernity and things. And what I took from this experience was like, oh, I want to know why, like how, and this was a thing that like, again, made sense and resonated because I've like experienced this in Ghana as well. So I left with questions, and that's what led me to first do a master's in African studies, researching what's called modern architecture, the history of that in Ghana, West Africa broadly, but specifically Ghana. And then led me to do a PhD in politics, where again, I was like, I'm studying histories and politics and theories of architecture.
Wow.
There's
so much.
No, go.
There's so much there that needs, I guess, we can go with this.
Yeah.
But I'm intrigued by, because I'm sure that your design didn't come out of a vacuum.
Mm.
No. It was properly researched based on the environment, mm-hmm. based on the history and all of that. And to go back to the people that you did this for them to feel a sense of rejection, for you to feel the sense of rejection that they presented to you because of, I don't want to use the word ignorance, but they were almost feeling like you were not rating them. You were putting them down.
Yes.
And didn't care to find out why you did what you did. The question is, how much of our architecture in our communities, Ghana, Africa primarily, are we allowing that sense of modernity to influence when it may not necessarily be the right form of architecture for us?
Oh, this is a big question. It's a dissertation question. So how I chose to answer this sort of questions and related question was to look into the history. Like, how do we get to this point where people that have these rich traditions of building, building things that fit in their climate, work for their culture, come to this point of like wanting, in my opinion, like really shoddy, ugly things with hot buildings with tin roofs and colonization, right? So using the example of Ghana, one thing that the British colonial government did, and they did in all the colonies, was to sort of eradicate like sort of people's connections to the land, to their cultures, to their histories and things.
Deliberately.
Okay. And there were different things they did. They did it through the legal system, different things, but architecture was also one of them. And again, using the example of Ghana, one thing they did was to first destroy old traditional things that people had links to, but also build imposing things. So the Cape Coast Castle, I was there recently, is built on the site of and with rocks that were quarried from, like there was this sort of rock formation that the people there worshipped as one of their gods. I forget the god's name. But they blasted it and then used some of the rock to build the fort that the Cape Coast Castle started from. So first of all, you imagine being someone from that community, you've not seen dynamite before, and then you see your god get blown up, and then you take the body of your god and build this fort, like in your face. It's the tallest thing you've ever seen. Mm. It's standing out, it's painted white, which is not a thing, how you build these things. So it's one, it has this, it's terrorism, like it brings this thing of fear in you. So there's that thing, and then there's also, there's like other ways, but there's also using of regulations. So they start introducing regulations about how we are allowed to build, where we are allowed to build on our own land. So one of these ones, which is part of the field research I'm doing now, is not allowing people to build in earth anymore. So it was illegal in Accra to build in earth. If any, they said any building facing the street, which was every building, couldn't be built in earth. You couldn't use thatch and things. So when you do it, people stop building that way, but also the builders with that knowledge also disappear. And now in Accra, you're not going to find any traditional Accra architecture in the way that they used to build before the British came. In Kumasi, there's like a few examples. Like even Mensah Palace was blown up, right? Like there was this building in Mensah Palace built in 1817 or something, anyway. But it was a kind of fortress museum that that Santehene had built, because they had been telling him about the big buildings in London that the Queen there had, and he was like, oh yeah, we can do that. So he had a group of fancy builders come and build this thing to show that he could also have it. 1874, British.
I think I've seen a photo of it in my friend's office, actually.
So like a lot of knowledge, a lot of technologies, techniques just got eradicated through like overt violence, but also through regulation, which is less overt, but also eradicates like a whole way of
That's crazy. Modernity, right?
Yeah.
Modernity, modernism.
Modernism is And even me, I have been affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
So I live in North Kaneshi, Awudome Estate. Awudome Estate was built by Kwame Nkrumah.
Mm. Right. Mm.
And one thing that I question myself, why did I do this? Is back then, the original we were building, right, had the window, it was wooden, and it had holes in.
Mm-hmm.
If you're outside, you can never see inside.
Jealousy is what they call it.
Mm. Jealousy.
Yeah,
you see, right? If it's closed,
yeah,
it still has ventilation.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So I was renovating this house quite recently, and the guy I was working with was like, I should use glass.
Mm.
I should use glass. Like, we fought and fought and fought. And everybody around me was like, glass. Like, you have to use glass. You have to use glass. And when I close this glass window, the heat is crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to go back to change it into that old style where when I close it, it will still get ventilation. I saw this modern house in Satamwen Town and it has that old school window. Modern house.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And it has that old. So why are we allowing ourselves for this to happen to us?
So I don't blame the clients per se. There's a reason why people move away there. And wait, before I even get there, just a funny aside.
Yeah.
So actually your jalousy windows was part of the original wave of architectural modernism. So when they brought this architectural modernism was a style that developed in post-war Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the white architects who started practicing here, they tried to import how they were doing it to flat roofs, large expanses of glass, but very quickly it didn't work because flat roof in Ghana, the rain would disgrace you.
Yeah.
So they adapted it to this climate. So this Nkrumah style, Awudome Estates, is that old school one with the jalousie window. So even that was a modified modernism. Modified.
Thanks for the proper pronunciation, by the way. Everyone has been saying jealousy.
Mm. Jalousie.
But it's like a French
jalousie.
Jalousie, wow. So even that was modified. And then now it's a more contemporary. This glass thing is a more contemporary one because people also associate that with the past. And it makes sense because you want to fit into your idea of the world, this global village that we're in. And you don't want to seem like you're backward. You want to show that you're successful, you're making it. And how do you show that you have AC and you have glass and things like that? And I think some of it is we don't have a kind of, one of my hot takes, we don't have a kind of established elite class that have upheld certain signs of things as taste. So this thing of people tiling their compounds, right? Yeah. That's what the very wealthy do, right? And then you put plastic trees.
These are around it.
So it's this is what people aspire to. We don't have, we don't have a lot of examples of people with wide lawns and lot of trees who are their tastemakers. So I think that's some of it, and what we associate with progress comes for that. It's a hot take.
Yes.
But I think
it reminds me of something. You're probably gonna navigate your way out around this question I'm asking because it's so important, I think, culturally to have tastemakers because they dictate what's happening. I think Mutombo for now, the jalousy window, if you decide to do it, will be so iconic. Because whether you choose to accept it or not, you are a tastemaker of sorts. Young people look up to you. You're in the public space. They aspire to be Mutombo did do. So if you do it, they're going to look at the house they're going to see the beauty in it. And then decide that they want to experiment. But we don't have enough people who are trying to push the boundaries, like this AstroTurf thing. We have grass in this country in abundance. And we have soil in abundance. I think for you to go out of your way to do artificial grass is some of the most backward way of...
It's crazy. It's actually crazy.
It's crazy.
It's not even nice to walk on.
It's irritating. And it can hurt
people. So I was going to say, I have football players who tell me that, Charlie, that turf, you know, weakens their knee.
Yeah.
Like, it's so crazy.
Because you have to put hard ground before you can stick the thing on top of it. Yeah. So you're running on concrete to play with. The earth is supposed to give you some bounce.
It's supposed to be springy. Yeah.
I don't get it. My son trains with this team, with this soccer, you know. And I'm just thinking, in the next 10 years, what is he going to tell me? Daddy, my knee, at the age of like 14, 15, 16, like, you're going to complain about your knee.
Yeah.
AstroTurf, it's good you are bringing it. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It should be banned.
Yeah, it should. Kukua, let's come to the ground.
Okay. Yes.
Let's come, literally.
We're on the ground.
Let's come to the ground. Ghana, real estate. Fred is into real estate.
Aren't we all?
Fred.
Right now, we wake up and we're like, Charlie, I did real estate. Yeah, that's what we all say.
Fred is into real estate. But before we even come to real estate, like planning, you know, we have flooding in Accra, in Ghana. And the reason is people are building in waterways. Mm, like people are doing this, people are doing this. What is the issue, or what, like, why are we here? Like, why do we allow these things to happen? You are in the field. Like, what is, why? Like, adding, you know, yeah.
Again, more PhD dissertation questions, which I love, by the way. Mm. There's so many reasons. One of my profs from KNUST once wrote that, like, Ghana has an architecture identity crisis, which, I partly agree with. And I think it's even multiple identity crisis. And it's not just architecture. It's a lot of interconnected systems. So when I was talking about this colonialism, the way they took control of the built environment, there's another kind of related interesting thing was... So, like, unlike in Southern Africa, in places like South Africa, where the sort of the white people went and just grabbed land, and they were able to grab land, they couldn't do it the same way in parts of West Africa, like Ghana, especially along the coast. You know, there was already a group of kind of cosmopolitan settled people who had ties already to Europe and the like. Some of them had legal training. So they were able to even send people to the Queen of England to argue their case for why, like, land could not be taken up from them.
You talked about David Say.
Wilson Say. Yes, yeah. And even, like, just even a generation before them, right? Like, they already had these networks. Yeah, there's a person I found, just stepping aside, who was kidnapped, probably, from Elmina, and was in the court of the Portuguese king. Like, this is like...
Yeah, is it 16. For...
Isabel, I think Isabelita, Hermanita. Okay. I'm probably not saying the name well. But this is like 1600s, somewhere there, right?
Yes.
So that's like these networks already happening. So they couldn't grab land the same way as they did in Southern Africa. So they had to be creative. And one of the ways that they're creative is like the building regulations that I've talked about. But some were also law. So they had this law that you couldn't bury in the home. You know, people used to bury in the home. Girl communities, they bury in the floor of the room you are born. Yeah. But when people bury people in the floor, they don't move because it's now ancestral land.
Yeah.
Mm. And the British want the land. They want to break the ancestral ties. So, like, everybody should bury in a cemetery. They say it's for hygiene. But there's an economic reason, like even the building regulations that we can't build in earth anymore. So this project I'm doing now, so I see these rules and I can't explain how my mind works, but I see these rules and like I had this idea to look at colonial reports on Ghana and look at export and import. And at this time, around the time they have established this rule and they're enforcing it, imports of building materials from Britain to Ghana are increasing. Cement. Like, of we course. Don't produce that there, of right? Course. So there's also economic reasons for some of that. So it's interconnected. And then there's also this thing that I also bring, which is like the invention of private ownership of property. Mm. Again, traditionally, land is Ebusia land or is held by the chief in trust for the community, right? And almost all land in Ghana is supposed to, like, originally fall under this. Because there's nothing, I think I tell people, there's nothing like empty land. owned by nobody in Ghana. Don't let anyone trick you. There's no such thing. There's always an owner. Go and find the owner. But it's supposed to be families and the community.
Yes.
But then with the British, they come and then they bring this idea of like private ownership of property.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going for a loan, you can mortgage your house, which is on family land.
Yes.
And if you default, then it's like taken. So a lot of things are broken. Like we're lacking connections to things because you're not established, you're not cultural. So again, one of my hot takes is like cemeteries look like crap because people don't have that tie to that area. Right? Like when you are burying people at home as part of it, you venerate your ancestors on their daily. If you go and put them somewhere on the outskirts, well, Awudome, you're talking about Awudome estates, right? Like you break a thing and then it takes so long to reestablish links with that thing.
Yeah.
So there's so many reasons. There's a private property thing. There's like the building regulations that have like disrupted chains that were developed over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I don't like to blame. I don't like to say, oh, clients are ignorant or like, oh, the architects are not doing. Because architects are doing amazing things. They're trying to propose, like they try, they like do designs. But if you have such a consumer-led building industry, because you build based on what your clients can afford,
yes,
or want to pay for. Mm-hmm. So you can recommend the
as
best.
Much as you want. If they don't see the vision,
they don't see it. They don't see it, and they are not going to buy. And can you force them?
Yes.
No.
So that makes me want to ask you a question that I hadn't prepared for based on what you're saying. How much of the responsibility of the colonial imposition on our culture, they did it for all the reasons that we say, for economic, for dominance, to change the psyche because they want to have an impact.
Yeah.
How much of that responsibility have we taken on as a people to re-educate ourselves about, yes, maybe you don't necessarily want to bury your dad in the house, but if you understand why we were doing it and why they wanted us to stop doing it, then maybe we can come up with a different approach. Because and it's especially for someone who's an architect who's done the work and PhD of the history of why they did things. I'm very curious about how that influences, you know, the way we think. Because there's a reason for everything. If you don't know the genesis of it, not everyone is going to be able to get educated and do the research and have access to the material to learn. But somehow it's affecting us on a daily basis now. And you might think architecture is so different from culture and how people live, but it's so intertwined. So, yes, my question is, how much of that responsibility is, and who does that responsibility fall on to re-educate the people about the essence of who they are and how architecture is affecting the way that we live?
So I don't know who it falls on, but I definitely have taken on some of it. So my recent project, the one that was featured on the BBC, the Accra Archive project, one component of it was public-facing, producing things that people could read. But it's limited, right? So I can reach certain sectors of people. But myself, I keep thinking, like, is there a way that I can do something very... like a mass education kind of thing. Because like you said, it's connected in so many things. And sorry to bring us to the bill. These things come because we don't know how we got where we are. And again, a lot of things that we think are tradition, it's like the British wrote it down.
Mm-hmm.
Said there was, but it wasn't. And then it's difficult because I also I'm not like one of the proponents of like, oh, let's go back to do things how it was in the past. We're different people now. The world has changed. We can be influenced and inspired by it. We can think and like kind of critically pick what makes sense and works for us. But if we have like a core sort of aim in politics that like we're going to lift up everyone, starting with the least of us, you know, like I think it will work out. Like if there's like, let's... selfishness in the system, right? Less cruelty, less hatred. I think it is, but to be honest, like I don't know. I think it's so much bigger than just like architecture. It's just so connected. Like the thing I said Prof. Interfol wrote about, I think we're in multiple identity crises. Mm-hmm. And there's just like a supposed to be a multi-pronged approach. Like, I hope and I think it will happen that there will be like filmmakers beginning to think of like producing, because it's so powerful film, right?
Yes.
Like produce stuff from that
period. We have so many interesting stories.
But research, I hope, right? Like ask, look, I'm telling you that professors at the universities in Ghana, they would love to do this. Because like when you write a paper, like what, 3 academics read it. But you want, like the reason why people do this work is that they want it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they knew how to get it out there, they would get it out there. So if you go and like approach people, like in your cultural productions, like, because you also don't want to misinform, and then now we have to do other work of like undoing the misinformation.
Yes.
So just ask, like if you're doing historical projects, like find people, they will tell you how things were. I saw a clip for this movie. It's a Ghana movie. I saw it on Instagram because people were fighting over it on Twitter. That place. but like it was about like a Ghana, said the first Ghana or the only Ghana female paramount chief. I hope I'm not saying, well, someone in the comments said this. Mm. But I remember like there was a scene where a king had died and they were burning the body. And I remember I paused, I was like, huh, is this how they would have done their funeral? Would they have, because I don't know Ghana history, like Ghana burial history. But it gave me pause because I was like, is this accurate? And I hope it is. But like, just in making this, I just hope they like ask people who knew and they try to be like accurate, because like we don't want to undo stuff. But yeah, I hope like other creatives from other sectors like know, first of all, get to know it themselves and then want to do cultural production, because it'll be a slow process, but like it has to be multi-pronged. Like I can like write my papers. I try to do like public facing things like essays.
Are your papers available to the public?
Yeah, I try to do everything open access. Like actually everything I've written is open access.
Okay.
But it's because you're published in academic journals, like the barrier of entry is also. So I try to do a blog post associated.
Yeah.
And I used to think, I remember one time back when I was on Twitter, I tweeted like, I try so much to make my work accessible. I don't want to be verbose or stuff like that. I hope it's working. And then someone commented, they're like, hey, verbose.
Like, even the words you're trying to use to tell us.
I was like, oh man, that's true. Yeah. So
no, but I do feel like as an adult, once you cross the age of 15, verbose shouldn't be a challenge of a word.
Oh, but the Ghana school system, you can't blame.
No, that's the same one we all went to.
But different levels.
Yeah, that's
different.
True.
Yeah. That's true. Like the teacher themselves, look at the system they went through. So what are they going to teach you?
Tomo, you get something?
Yeah, so I mean, I gave one example, but I will, like, are we, generally speaking, are we building according to our climate?
No, the vast majority is not. Because also architects, like trained professionals, including architects, just do a tiny, tiny fraction of building in this country. Like most people build and they don't even think of involving any professional, they just do their thing. So even like even the sort of professional work, so even when architects, engineers specify materials and things, like another layer is that we are so import dependent. Like we're making very, very, very little here. So when you specify a glass window, you are, even when you've designed it to work with the climate, where they designed the glass window to be doesn't experience daily temperatures of 34 degrees Celsius. So like the sealing mechanisms, like the kind of plastic they use, was not tested for this kind of thing. So we have no idea what's happening. Like the contraction, the expansion, the cracking, microplastics that are leaching, because again, not all plastics are meant to be exposed to high temperatures, right? Like even the glass. So I was with a friend and I saw like a railing with this kind of glass thing. I was like, ooh, this looks, it could explode and hurt someone really bad one day. Because like, again, the kind of glass you should have that's like directly in the sun.
What kind of glass would that be?
So usually like a kind of tempered glass. So like there's sort of materials that they've developed for use in Dubai. Okay. Like that kind of thing, yeah. So, but I don't think this is what.
Okay. How about important. Laminated?
Well, probably as well. I'm but like, for I don't my know own if
personal
it's
use now.
Oh, well, yeah.
I ask.
No. But even beyond that, right? Like, yeah. It's like when you, because you are not importing glass yourself.
Yeah.
You're going to buy something someone has imported. Yeah. So, what are the chances that a person has like the detailed manufacturing records to see what stress test it was exposed? You don't even. So it's not even your fault as a builder or an architect. You. Again, so import dependent, market driven. So it's like whatever the biggest importer is in the mood for, he goes to China, he has all the money, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna do 5 tons of this aluco bond, and that's what's on the market.
Yes.
And you have to build with it. Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going back to this question of responsibility because I've been fighting myself for a while now. Where I'm back and forth between what they did to us and what we allowed to keep happening to us. And I kind of like, I mean, I think I've pivoted to what are we allowing to happen to us? Because at some point we have to have the curiosity about who we are, where we come from, because that's what identity is about. If you can't do that, you can never really have that sense of pride, sense of appreciation. You've spoken about some of it coming through film, which I think there's so much material that we can make so many interesting movies for different mindsets.
Yes.
For people to like absorb in and make the changes. But here we are again with Mutombo was asking about building, you know, regulations. We're kind of struggling with everybody, it's a free for all. Like, say, most people don't involve architects when they're doing so. For me, the good part about our interaction with the West is some of these professions, right? Engineering. That have titles and they have to, it's a discipline that you have to go through to be able to figure things out. I think we had our own ways of doing stuff, but now it's formalized.
It's different,
okay, so the formalization of that, maybe at independence, the question I'm asking is, was there ever a grand plan for us to not reverse course, but to sit down and say, how do we plan our future according to, Mutombo has asked the question about building according to our climate. To say that all these skills that we've acquired is not because we want to replicate the West, because it's an entirely different geographical experience. But how do we adapt those skill sets to our communities, our way of life, and how do we then improve upon those realities without just saying, okay, bring the brick from London? Like you're saying, the glass was not tested for Ghana.
Yeah.
Most of the vehicles we drive, they are not tested for Africa. Everything that we do is not meant for us inherently. We're just consuming it because
we don't do anything.
Yes.
We don't produce anything.
So was there ever a plan? Was there ever the gathering of the intelligentsia, the academia, all the words that you can, you know.
Punchline.
So what were we doing? What did we do at this when we had independence? Like, what was the plan?
So I love this question because there were so many plans and there were many people trying to do things, right? There was a Building and Road Research Institute. There was the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. But people like asking themselves these questions and trying to answer them, and of course they take time. But like that's part of the problem. So like again, like that, I'm also in that balancing act thing, like how much of it is colonialism, how much of it is us refusing to use common sense, you know?
Yeah.
Like how, like, but this, man, the effects of colonialism are so deep. They are so deep. So even this formalized profession, like how were we trained? Like even when I was in tech, my arc science course, we're still learning HVAC systems. That, like, in my adulthood, I've never seen in a building, like, calculation. Because we're trained on those standards, right? Because people were trying, but it takes time. It takes, like, experimentation. It takes investment in the sciences and the research, which, unfortunately,
Yeah, unfortunately, we'll rather build 7 houses in Kweu than pour into the science department.
Even the 7 houses in Kweu, right? If you did it,
no offense to people from Kweu, I'm just saying.
Yeah, or like I'm from Anmarble, 7 houses in Anmarble, whatever. Yeah. that even if those ones were done properly, right? So it's a thing. So again,
no, I meant as in, I have this idea that legacy-wise, the West has people or had people, still has people, who are willing to invest in the discipline.
Yes.
So if an architect as curious as yourself and as willing to do the work, there would be the backing, financial backing, so that you can just do what you love. And I'm saying that instead of doing that, we're interested in building homes that don't fit the climate, that don't benefit anybody, that your family members are going to be fighting over when you die. Compounding problem upon problem.
100% agree with you. But I'm saying that even that, right? So there's 7 houses in Kweru. So if, because it's also like that balance between the colonialism and things. So like, okay, you, this politician, you want to chop this money. Even when you are chopping it, right? Like if you, again, hired like an architect and gave them the freedom to actually think and apply and not just go and use this aluko bond that your brother imported, right?
Yes.
Like, again, we're talking about the influence of like sort of people, like influencers, like things they build and people looking up. So even if those people, right, even with their chopping of their money and building in groove, they built stuff that like was really thoughtful, like responding to the climate, responding to the culture, because again, they hired someone and gave them the support to do it. Like it would even be a different story. So like even if we they were chopping with a view towards, with purpose, right? But it's like,
Charlie,
what do you think? I know you've seen the design, of the cathedral. what do you think about the design?
Oh, the design there is nice. Like the person who did it is a world class architect, and there's a reason.
David J. Yeah.
There's a reason why he is so influential.
Is he still in the business? Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he is.
But they might have taken off the project.
No, there's been a scandal about. Oh,
I know about it.
Yeah, there was a Financial Times story.
What do you think of his work? His, you know, design.
The cathedral design.
No, like that, and you know his other, you know.
I mean, it's like.
Knighted, I think he was knighted by the Queen.
Oh, he was.
Wasn't knighted that thing that the Queen possessed?
Yes.
But have they taken it back or is still.
Why should they take it back?
Maybe scandal. Or...
No, but. I don't think so. Yeah.
I'm not saying they should take it, though. I was just asking.
I don't think they have. But no, about the cathedral as well. Like, I mean, it's like, well, beautiful gowns. It's like a nice design. But like, is this what we need, right? Like at this point. And some of it, like, I know that architects will argue and say like, oh, for them, they're being hired to do something. So it's not their problem what the government has decided to build and they don't have any influence. And it is true to some extent. But like, also, I don't know.
What do you think of the architecture? Sorry.
I was actually, if you were hired to design the you know, cathedral, would you say no? Or would you?
Oh, I would definitely say no.
Why?
But I'm like even me entering academia, finding like other things to do that are my income things, is because of my approach to architecture. I didn't want to, like, I really, really hated doing what I call corporate kind of things. Like, I don't enjoy the kind of like, again, the market driven kind of thing. So like, I don't mind if like clients don't have enough money, but I like that if they will trust you to think and come up with solutions and like that kind of thing. But sometimes you have a design and you do the design and you give it to the person and you go to the site and they'll be like, oh, my foreman said this would be better, so I've changed this.
Like, the audacity.
I'm like, wow.
Foreman over architect.
So maybe the foreman does know things better. But like, can you like trust that this is coming from somewhere and like, let's talk about it. So I didn't enjoy that at all. So very early on, I was like, oh, okay, if I'm going to do work in design, I'm going to need it to not, like, I'm going to need it not to be my only source of income so that I'm not driven by like necessity or desperation or things like that. So that was one of the reasons why I was doing some of these other things, because like I was like, okay, yeah, so this will pay me and then I can experiment and do stuff another way.
But I heard the money behind the cathedral was huge.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I'm pretty
sure. And then you would have said no.
But, you know, like you said, I'm also, like, I do my activist stuff. It's, like, it's my politics, like, certain things. Like, how can I?
Yeah, you mentioned foreman, you know, I want to ask this question. What's the difference between a draftman or is that the word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A draftman and an architect?
It's the training and what they are legally, is that the word, allowed to do. And trained to do. So, again, the training for architects is usually like to kind of design, understand the whole building process, understand what the different engineers and just different professionals do and bring it all together to be able to supervise it. And traditionally, draftsmanship has been about sort of drawing out the architects and the other professional designs.
Oh, okay.
So again, I'm saying traditionally, because I suspect, I haven't checked, but I suspect that the education has probably broadened a bit because, again, by necessity in Ghana, you have to do a lot of things. So, again, traditionally, the draftsman is like draws out what the architects or the engineers design.
A couple of years ago, you've been very, very vocal online, in person for people like me who know you, you are always, you know, speaking your mind, I'm expressing how you feel about the country, especially, and all that. A couple of years ago, like 2-3 years ago, you were part of a bunch of people who stormed the Parliament House to protest. They were going to build something like the chamber, they were going to rebuild it or something, and you decided to express your disapproval by joining, you know, some fighters to storm Parliament House. Can you share, you know, your experience that day? Because I was there. I was sitting right next to you.
That's why I'm laughing at your use of the word storm. We walked very gingerly and gently to our allowed seats as members of the public participating in our nation's democracy. Yeah, we are allowed to. I mean, the government doesn't agree, but it's legal, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to build a new chamber for Parliament in a time where we felt really this shouldn't be their priority. It was going to cost the country so much. It was not necessary. There's more pressing needs. So we thought they shouldn't. So a group of us had decided to go up to the gallery and really just hold up posters. That kind of thing. So that was the plan. It was much more gentle than Mutombo is putting it. But once we were in there, one of our number was probably overcome with, definitely was probably overcome with anger and passion. Because I'm pretty sure he was sitting there, he was listening to all this. And Charlie, the country is frustrating. And he was hearing all this and he was really upset. So he got up and shouted, I forgot what he said, but then he ended with drop that chamber now. And then the security people tackled him, really manhandled him and took him out. I think they even, I'm not sure if they charged him with something, but they took him to the prison or the police station there. And he was held there for a while. And yeah, they came and threatened me as well.
Yeah.
And this is maybe one of the rare instances of female privilege, because maybe I'd have gotten some slaps if I was a man. But
they were calm with you.
Yeah, he was like, if you fool, get out. And I was like, I don't know. I've not been slapped. I don't know what it is like. So I'm like, okay. I don't think I'll do well with a military slap. I was like, okay, fine. Because I was like, because they were manhandling the guys. Yeah. And I was like, no, you can't do this. Like, you're not supposed to do this. And he was like, I looked around. And I was like, no support. So I'm okay. Yeah. Let me just follow.
Why do you feel, or why have you been expressing your you know, disapproval, like, through your social media, you know, platforms, and like, why do you feel the need? Because you are not even based here.
Yeah.
Right? You are not even based here. Well, maybe back then you were based here.
Back then
here.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, but now you are not here, but I know that you are still in tune with things going on the ground, especially with the current wave of demonstrations and protests. Like, why do you think you still have to tap in? Why do you think you still have to speak? Like, go, like, you are there, go, chill, like, you are in Michigan, like, you know.
I mean, it's my country, and, like, I want things to be good for the least of us. Like, I want, let me talk a bit about my mom. My mom is, like, such a generous person. So at every stage in my life growing up, we've always, and she was a teacher, we've always had groups of people that she's helping, she's feeding and things. So I joke that I started paying school fees early, even when they were still paying school fees for me, right? So I don't want to see people like begging. Like, there's something that erodes your dignity. Like, you have to come and beg someone, oh, like, my child is sick, like, I need 20. I'm like, I don't want them to have to go through that. I want them to be able to go and have affordable healthcare. I want them to have a job that pays well. Like, I want dignity for people. Like, I think people actually in Ghana enjoy having, like, being richer than other people.
That is true.
I don't want it. Like, I know it's like human nature, it will happen, but like, I want like a country where, like, if you work in a shop, you should be able to live a decent life. Like, yes, you're not wealthy, you're not driving expensive cars, but like, if you're hungry, you get food to eat. If you're sick, you can go to the hospital. You can send your kids to school. That's what I want. Like, it's my politics. Like, I don't know where it comes from, but I just want this. I just want a country to work. So that's why I complain. The difference between what I was doing when I was based in Ghana and now that I'm not is that now I support and I amplify, but I don't organize protests anymore. And Mutombo, you know, like, I used to organize. But I don't organize because, like, I think if I'm not going to be there and put myself on the line, I shouldn't ask other people to. So if they are doing it and they're like, please retweet, please donate, I will. But I won't. The thing I don't do now is I don't organize, because, like, I think if you're going to protest, you should be, if you're going to protest, you should be in front.
Is that the only reason, though? It's not because, like, you are a professor now, you are standing in front of, you know, people to talk. That isn't it.
And also another thing I do is, like, so I don't do protests, like, in the country. I don't organize because, like, I also think, like, you have to be in community with people and stuff, and, like, I haven't lived there long enough to actually know the thing. So again, when people are doing, I will support, I will amplify, but to say that I'm going to bring people together, like, I don't. Again, that's just how I am. I know people have different opinions about it, but
It's interesting because you're informed by a lot of your political views. You said you wouldn't have done the cathedral.
Yeah.
You want people to live with dignity.
Yeah.
And then earlier on in one of your responses, you said you've tuned out almost because you feel like the bad guys are winning.
Yeah.
And for me, that's a collation of so many different elements.
Yeah.
Things that are happening that you must be in an internal struggle with yourself. My question to you is, based on those feelings, those emotions, those thought processes, how much of it affects you on a daily basis? But also, what do you think it is that informs the way you've become? What was your upbringing? Or what were you encountering? What were you reading that led you to be the person that you are today?
It's an interesting question. So upbringing-wise, I'll put a lot of stuff on my mom. And it's not like I consciously knew it, but, like, especially now as an adult, like, I see her now and I remember things that she should do. She's, like, really generous to the extent that, like, I used to get angry as a kid to have to be sharing my stuff. She's, like, a really kind-hearted person. Like, I've met very few people like her. I don't get it. I'm not naturally like this. Like, she would do it just... because that's the right, or I don't know, I don't know her reason, but she would just do it for that reason. And me, like, I'll have, like, a more, like, structured thought process and that kind of thing. But it doesn't come as naturally to me as it comes to her. So that's, like, a big part of it. And also, like, reading, I just read widely as a kid because I read really fast. And my parents bought me books by weight and volume rather than content, because they're like, okay, what will shut her up for the next, for the longest time, so she's not asking us for another book. So, yeah, I was just, like, exposed to, like, different ways of being beyond what they were teaching me in class. So, yeah, there's some of that. So, it's not, I haven't, like, I tuned out of constant social media updates because there's a lot of stuff designed to depress your spirit. So, that's what it is. So, I haven't tuned out, like, so I forget this author, but the person talks about hope as a discipline that you have to practice. So, it's not like you're hopeful just because, but it's a thing you have to think of the future you want and work towards it. So I try to practice that, but like what I was expressing, like currently with everything that's happening, it's harder and harder to like think of the future. So I find myself currently now returning a lot to histories of different civilizations and reminding myself that like throughout history, one constant is that oppressive regimes will fall. And some things are the last dying gasps of a dying civilization. Because if you go and look at different histories of different civilizations, towards the end, some of the wildest things happen, like these massacres and things, which is like sad, like, because like, again, I wish people wouldn't have to go through this.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I try to remind myself and then also remind myself of all the people who are doing so much with so little. And, like, just, again, dreaming and working towards, like, a future that's good for everybody. But, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Tough. But the other thing is that you said your mom was very generous.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to kind of think about what it is that we didn't take from who we are.
Yeah.
Versus what we've become.
Yeah.
And I took note of you saying that you think in a more structured way.
Yeah.
Than...
Not structured, but like kind of more calculated.
Calculated, kind of okay. Yeah. So I would dare say that it feels like that's almost a Western thing to do in being calculated. Mm. But I'm asking your opinion because I want you to explain how you feel about it.
Yeah.
I grew up around people like that as well.
Mm.
I can point to my grandma being the most generous person I know, my granddad being the same, or my father, or my auntie, or wherever. I'm tending to believe that they have more sense of community than we do. And I think the way that we are is more westernized than they were.
Yeah.
Whereas I grew up, I read a lot, very widely, but then I organized my thoughts in ways that I thought was more, I'm going to use the word I use, the structured way of, I'm like, why is my dad doing that? That doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Why is my mom doing that? That doesn't make sense. But their generosity was more community-based and they had a rhyme and reason for that.
Yeah.
We seem to say, no, this is, we're more the privatization of land. Mm-hmm. This is mine. This is, no, stay kind of thing. Do you feel the same way? How much of that do you think is preventing us from maybe achieving the kind of dignity you want everyone to be able to participate in?
Yeah, this is pretty much spot on. Like, I definitely agree that they had, like, this sense of communality that came from how they were raised, which is has eroded more in our time and will be even worse for those that come after us. Again, like, so everybody has their house with their gate and they go in and they shut. They don't know their neighbors. It's getting worse than before. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. So, like, the calculating I meant. So, I think, like, the way our parents, our grandparents, who were generous thought, was also structured, but it was a different, there's a different goal of living with people and how to live than us, which, again, bringing this term of the multiple identity crisis, again, is that we come from this tradition where you're supposed to be with people and you are because of other people. But then they've also raised us to fit in this world, which has driven this westernized idea of individualism. So we have these clashes. So like, even if you want to be your own self, you want to be like selfish or whatever, you're going to have some cousin or some auntie that's going to be like, oh, I need this. Like, it's these battling things that are happening. So when I talk about like calculating to try and be generous and live in community with people is because I don't have that natural thing, the way that my mom was raised.
Yes.
Like I wasn't raised in such a community, so I don't have it. So I have to like, so it's different now, but earlier on, like my natural instinct is like, again, how you raised, I'm an individual. But then I have to remember that, oh no, like you are part of a community and it's better for everybody to come up in the community. That's like remind myself of like what I think is important.
Okay.
Top. Last segment then.
Yeah.
Your archival project. Mm. I mean, I was at the archive, whatever, at the University of Ghana.
Oh, in like, KTR Archives.
Yeah, last year. And what I saw was so devastating. I've gone to the National Archives before, and the way they keep stuff there is so sad.
Mm. But cathedral.
Yes. this is your mouth. Yeah. Why did you feel the need to do this? Mm. And how was it? How did you get money to do this?
Mm.
Yeah.
So the archive project started when I was doing research for my MSc. So I did an MSc in African Studies at Oxford, and my final dissertation was, like I said, I wanted to track this history of the modernist architecture in Ghana. So in my going round, I was like trying to interview people who had been practicing architecture or being in the building industry from like as long, like the oldest people, draftsmen, architects, engineers I could find. So I was in some corners because when I'm on a trail of research, I do some pretty silly and dangerous things. Mm. So like I remember, I'll meet this person, be like, follow me, take me somewhere. I also go, I always say, don't do it. Don't be like, Kukwa, don't do that. Don't go. But anyway, it led me to this, all these things led me to this room with all these documents. And like, it was amazing for my project. It was like original, never before used kind of thing.
Wow.
But as I was getting, like I was there, I was like, oh my God. So, and the material, a lot of them were crumbling in my hands as I touched them.
Mm.
I was like, oh, I cannot be the only person. So that thing of the community, right? Like, I cannot be the only person who uses it. Like, I can't. Actually, I even can't because that's, like, thousands of documents, number one. But also, like, other people, like, this should be there for other Ghanaians, especially other scholars to be able to use. So that gave me the idea. So I went to my supervisor at the time, the late Professor Deutsch, and he told me of this grant run by the British Library. Mm-hmm. It's called the Endangered Archives Grant. So I applied for it. Mm-hmm. And then got it to set up this project. So the project was just to like preserve this material in some form for future generations. Mm. So, yeah, that's
yeah. So and I remember with the BBC interview that I saw, or I read somewhere that you were going to put it on a website where people can have access. Is it up now?
Yeah, it's up there. It's the digital materials.
Oh wow!
And what's the name of the website?
EAP, I can give you that.
What one, did you see any documents that blew your mind?
There were like interesting little things. So like a permit for like building a boat house for like a boat club, which I was like, oh, this was a thing. Like there's like interesting ones and like nice, like interesting structures and stuff. But I think one of the things as like looking at the collection as a whole was like, oh, this is not just a record of the formalization. You talked about formalization earlier. It's also a record of something else. Again, part of the project I'm currently working on, the book project I'm working on, is like in sometimes in the margins, like you see a document and someone has applied and said, I'm applying for a permit to build in Swish. Swish is mud basically, and roof with thatch. And then the official, the British colonial official, will cancel it and say, cancel the swish and put brick and say, and whitewashed and roof with aluminum. And I was like, there's something else happening here. And that's before the formal building regulations starts coming into effect. It's also a record of what I'm calling the unformalization of the building construction industry of architecture, architectural technologies also in the country. And that's like taking the whole thing like together.
Mm-hmm.
That's also because these are colonial archives. They are not meant to be a record of what indigenous people did.
Mm-hmm.
But reading kind of in these notes and like in between the lines and looking at other sources, you see that's also telling you another process. Yeah.
So crazy. I feel cheated actually because I know that the podcast is coming to an end. Maybe I would beg to get your number because there's several conversations I want to have beyond here.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to bring something back to think like a running theme. Mm. We've talked about colonialism, how horrible it is. Then you say something that's also sticking out to me very profoundly about discovering this archive and then the chain of going to a professor who led you to a resource that has been established to help preserve this thing. And I want to tell you something. I want you to tell me what you think about what I'm saying. The colonialists, when they came, they were capitalist, they were economic driven, they were cronyist, they were trying to do a lot of things. So they've come to a foreign land, they feel like the people they've come across are backward, primitive, whatever the case may be. Their knowledge of life, technical existence and all of that, what they do is, in their mind, without much research, have determined that what we have is substandard. Aluminum sheets is better. Don't use starch. Use this. And we can sell it to them and we can make money, blah, blah, blah. So they've done all of that. And now we are left holding the bag because we haven't done the work to evolve our touch process, how we roof, where it's airy and everything. We haven't done that. So we convert to theirs automatically. But what is it with us that now a brilliant mind like Kukwa has gone on a journey of self-discovery, let's call it that. And if it is not for the British Fund, fuck it. Fuck it.
Yeah.
There's nothing here, no one here, that would have stood by you and said, you know what, this is worth preserving. That is the part of responsibility that breaks my heart because I'm like, well, how long can we keep doing this shit? And there's so much that's going to be lost because the funding is not there and there are not enough people who are just as brilliant and lucky to find themselves through their own personal curiosity and desire to, you know what, I'm going to get to the end of it, that will be able to find everything that needs to be found for us to be able to properly record. Because I feel like our evolution was interrupted.
Yeah.
By this colonization. Yeah. And it's just our responsibility to self-correct. Because no one is coming to do it for us. And I'm just fucking frustrated. Sorry. I don't know what you feel about that. But that's what I wanted to say.
It's definitely frustrating. I hear you and everything. But I like a word you used. You said as lucky. Because I say this and people think I'm capping. But like, there's so much brilliance here. Like, unpublished dissertations from people, students who have to do their final project work under like terrible circumstances. Like, there's a wealth of things. Like, people are thinking, if you support them, if they get lucky, like, so much can come out of it. So, like, again, like, through this project, a thing I wrote into Rich, which is not usually a thing done in academic projects, was to get a group of, I call them fellows, but like, kind of young people to engage and explore and create stuff around these archives. I ran a competition. Like, children entered like drawings of like the oldest building. They were supposed to tell stories about history and stuff. So I think like these little seeds, right? Like, just like sowing a seed in someone's mind, and then they will be. So like, I don't want this stuff to end with me. Like, I'm not interested in like, oh, just Kukwa did it and was so great and that's a full stop. Like,
yes.
The ones who come after me should do better and do bigger things, just as like I also came after someone who also opened. So like, we're just building and going. And I get the hopelessness. I think like maybe this is a thing to end on. When people talk about hope as a discipline, it's like also, and because I'm a historian, like, it's also looking at history, because like, it's very easy when you hear historical stories to think that things happen quickly.
Yes.
Like in a short time. But these processes take so long. It's painful.
Yeah.
And you will not see certain changes in your lifetime. But like 500 years later, there'll be a Mutombo Junior, who will now be like, So these guys started this If More Less Divide podcast. Mm-hmm. And then like 50 years later, this thing happened. And then it will look like an easy story, a breeze of how there was this change in the cultural space in Ghana. But when it's happening, it's painful and it's slow. But hope as a discipline, it's like, think of that future that we will not see. Like,
are we practicing it enough? Hope as a discipline.
Oh, you have to. You have to.
Dope.
Yeah. I love
I mean, last question. Do you have a life? Yeah, because it looks like you are doing so much. Like, you are here, you know, for work. You know, you have to go back. You have to come back. Like, do you have a life?
I do. I did not earlier. But it's also unfortunately part of the process in this capitalist world when you're like trying to get a foot in. And also, like, if you're trying to get a foot in when you are coming from like a kind of disadvantage in quotes background. But I do. I try so hard to sleep. I make sure I sleep. And I make sure to do things that bring me joy.
Like, do you get out and go and sit somewhere, like, for drinks, for dinner, for lunch? Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you have kids?
I don't have kids.
I'm asking this for me because I know. I'm asking for, you know.
I don't have kids because currently I'm still terrified. So I love teaching. I love teaching. And I like them when I'm, like, interacting in limited capabilities. But honestly, like, I'm really terrified of them. No. I do not have kids. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. Fred, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Last question.
Last question. Thank you for coming. It's been quite insightful. I'm actually more keen on your mind than I've ever been. But if you had that magic wand or that silver bullet to
shoot someone,
to bring some sort of sense to our architectural landscape, when you look at what's happening from. I wanted to ask you about affordable housing.
I wanted to ask you what we can do
to change the circumstances of young people here and people living with dignity, like you said, and not being asked to come up with rent for a year. And all of
three
and building,
years.
Charlie, crazy things that don't make sense for our ecosystem. What one area would you say I will be able to make the most impact if you were given the power to make the most impact in whatever area you choose? Where would your focus be?
I thought about this a lot, especially the magic wand thing. So it has to be completely magic and fantastical. And the thing that I keep coming to is what I would do if I could wave a wand is to make people care about people who are in them or their families. I think if people in the world, in Ghana specifically, but in the world broadly, just care about their lives and happiness and dignity of other people, it will just have such a kind of rule on effect on everything.
In its own way, that's why I've always hated that sentiment of, oh, it could be your sister, it could be your brother. Because that brings it back to blood related. It doesn't have to be.
It shouldn't.
You have to care about people because they're human.
Yeah, people.
And once you limit it to, oh, well, what if it was my sister? Then you reserve your empathy
for your blood, for your family.
Charlie, dope. It's been an amazing conversation. Back to the old lingua.
Yes.
Charlie, guys, we have Kuku Amanfo.
I thought you said you were not doing that anymore.
No, the end.
Like, okay. Yeah.
So, wait, did you change your surname?
No.
You didn't change your surname?
I like my surname.
Oh, wow. So you're still Amanfo?
Yeah.
That's dope. And Charlie Fred, like I told you, like Kuku is, you know, pure spirit.
Yes.
I've never told her this, but you know, you can feel her presence in the room. Very, very calm, but firm.
I feel like the audience is going to feel shortchanged because they're going to feel like it was short. But that's just me, my selfish stance,
you know,
right now.
Very, very firm with her words. Very, very on point. Always, in every way. And it's been a dope conversation. I've learned, a few things. Very, very few things. But I wanted to talk about affordable housing and rent.
Yes.
Charlie.
Or maybe you can tell us briefly what you think about the housing.
Oh, affordable housing is not a thing in Ghana, and we need stronger laws. You're leaving me on a note that will annoy people.
Please, let's annoy them before we go.
We need laws around how much property you can own. We need limits. We need taxes on inheritance. We need so many things. Because a lot of this is because, like, few people are accumulating so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, it's a thing that's a rule. It's a rule on, rollover, what's the term? That effect is, like, coming from something else. Like, everything, you can't trust anything in this country because it's run. So land is, like, the last big investment. So, yeah.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, Charlie, on that note, you guys.
Charlie.
The Masempa. Charlie, it's been a dope conversation, an amazing conversation, and we thank Kukua Manfo for coming through the podcast, the thank F you. More Let's Divide podcast, season 4. We are here, Fred.
Yes, sir.
We are through.
Thank you.